We are talking about the politically correct matrix with Patrick Henningsen. Welcome back here to the second hour. And we have much more, of course, to discuss coming up here. I just wanted to make one more point, and that was regarding something you mentioned before, Patrick, about basically the idea of bullying or basically how to, what has been the norm when it comes to how helping yourself has changed as well. But I think that one of the most rewarding part, there are some good authors, by the way, that have written on the counter thing to all the bullying stuff. But the fact is that when the nanny states takes away from you your ability to, you know, to basically defend yourself, stand up for yourself, you become dependent on them to solve issues, deal with problematic situations. That's also actually the very point of the engineering that goes on then. They want to make you dependent on basically coming to them to solve all the issues, making you incapable of wheeling and dealing something, you know, on your own. It would basically take away your ability to organize or get together with other people or have the gratification afterwards when the fact is done, when you've conquered an issue, whether that's, you know, bullying or something that you consider to be unfair, whatever it is. That whole ability is something I believe that's very, very important to the human being, specifically even to small children. We've talked about this before, but no matter how difficult that process is of having someone who's bullying another kid, the fact is that that child will be 10 times stronger when they've managed to overcome something. They will be more confident. It's building self-esteem and everything else. It builds character, right? So negative situations, things that are difficult, things that are very much a trial for you to go through, is something that's ultimately going to be very beneficial. And that's one of the basic points. I think that they've understood that from a psychological point of view, that, all right, if we take away that ability for them, we'll have them come to us and ask for help instead of solving it on their own, that we will actually create individuals with a weaker character. Now, do you think they are on that level psychologically, you know, up to speed, and they know that this is how they're going to try to create and form, you know, a population under them to be subjugated to the rule? What do you think, Patrick?
I think it's already been hardwired into society, especially if you look at, you know, in Europe, the benefits culture or the entitlement culture has really been hardwired into successive generations post-World War II, whereby there's a heavy amount of people that are dependent on the state for a number of bits of assistance or help with this or help with that, so much to the point now where it's a complete entitlement. And of course, America is catching up very quickly to this, because America is seeing the benefits of this. This particular political establishment that's in power in America right now are seeing that this is actually the way forward. We heard from the bank governor of the Bank of England saying that it's good to have a certain amount of unemployed people, that the optimum number is you know, around 11 or 13%, you know, because these are people that can be controlled politically in ways that you can't imagine, as if they were free agents and they're out, you know, on the open field themselves doing their own thing. Be very, very difficult to corral them into a particular political situation. And so, yes, the state taking over that whole experience, which is really starts in early education, and that concept of not being able to fail, you know, you take failure out of the equation. The only things that you really learn in life, the only really valuable lessons, the hard lessons, are learned from failures.
Yeah.
And I don't know anybody who can tell me otherwise, because any expertise I have or anything that I've ever achieved is usually come on the back of some failure before that.
That's really right. Yeah.
Grasp what I was doing. I was doing it wrong. The timing was wrong. I didn't have enough, you know, drive or fortitude or expertise, or I didn't work hard enough, or I didn't have the right equipment, you know, et cetera. I wasn't being advised by the right people. You learn these things from failure, and you come back a lot stronger and a lot more focused. And of course, that's a process that I was luckily allowed to learn when I was a kid, and so good at it. I failed more times than I've succeeded, but most people have actually,
yeah,
in their life.
Definitely,
the number of failures usually exceed the amount of successes. And I was speaking to one of the radio hosts on GMN who came on my show as a guest. His name was E.T. Williams. And this guy's, I mean, talk about a a champion of free speech. This guy's incredible. He's a black man from the South, and he's a black conservative, he calls himself.
Well, that's so rare.
Yeah, so, and he really goes after the president and everything, but he told me that his children, they went away from giving awards to the children in the sports programs, like baseball and the kids, because they didn't want the kids who didn't win to feel left out.
Right, no one wins. Yeah, we've heard that.
Yes, yep. It's about participating that matters, right?
So that's all good, right? That's going to create good, nice, children when they grow up, right?
Sure. Yeah. No, you didn't lose. You just the other person just went, or they stopped the game in when it's a tie. You know, I've worked with kids before in sports on the sports side, and it's horrific when they get absolutely pounded. Like 6-0 in a soccer match.
Sure.
One side is just going to be in tears. But it doesn't matter because these kids are just perked up and they're going to be happy and smiling and running around an hour later. Okay. They get over it. So who be me to sort of shield them from the pangs of loss and defeat?
And in fact, next time they'll try 100 times harder and try to really effectivize their game to win, right? That's how you develop good players in soccer.
That's how it works.
You lose and then you go forward. I mean, it's like, it's so fundamental. I can't even believe we're having this conversation right now.
I know it is fundamental, but a lot of people are being shielded from this as young children these days. And also there's a lot of parents that are complying with this agenda as well, I'm afraid to say. And E.T. Williams said he pulled his kids out of the sports program. He said, I'm not going to have my kids in any sports. It's not giving her out first, second, third place awards.
Yeah.
He pulled his kids out. He's got two or three kids. And so I tip my hat to E.T. Williams, and I'm thinking,
certainly,
he walks the walk. He doesn't just talk the talk. And he's applying this in his, family life as well, and whatever his personal values are. And I think that's great. And I think all parents and children should do that. It starts in the schools. If you see these things starting to manifest themselves at a primary school level in secondary education, and you can kind of glean this from what your children are telling you or what you're seeing is going on in school and in sports and other activities, you should have a pretty good idea of how your child is being educated and indoctrinated. If you're paying attention, you should be able to see these things.
Yeah.
Because you have your own experience, which you drew from as a child, so you can compare the two, so it's like, when my parents brought us up, they probably saw things they recognized. Oh, I remember that. That's the same thing we did when we were a kid. Now you have the new generation of kids. There's a disconnect between our generation and the current generation. They're indoctrinating right now. So a lot of things are missing. A lot of things have been wiped out. That were kind of standards for previous generations, mm-hmm. and being replaced by different things. And what are those things? And we're seeing some evidence of what some of those things are. And it's very dark stuff.
Yeah.
The suicide education. We need to teach children about suicide. Oh. And so what's that? What kind of seed is that planting in the kid's head?
Well, exactly.
I had no suicide education as a kid. I also didn't get indoctrinated into Class A drug education at the age of 11 or 12.
Lana and I talked about this last night, actually, this very issue. And it's like, what's obvious here is that, again, the psychologists behind this, they understand reverse psychology. If you want to introduce something and talk negatively about it, that's where kids going to go to rebel later on, right? But the parents don't seem to understand that basic point and think, very well now. You tell them how bad things are, right? I mean, how can people not understand that basic premise that if you introduce it to them and talk negatively about something, that's what they're going to go do,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what's happening. And then, of course, they're introducing sex education earlier in the curriculum.
Same thing.
And in a place like California, which is the sort of liberal bastion of the world at the moment, the cutting edge of applied liberal behavioral psychology, there just passed a law whereby that students are allowed to nominate their gender from as young as the age of 6, I believe. So they have unisex toilets, unisex locker rooms, and say if a boy wants to decide that he's a girl that day, he then can be on the girls' sports team Wow. And he can be in the girls' bathroom and the girls' changing rooms and vice versa.
Oh, boy.
If a girl wants to be a boy, if she says, oh, God has cheated me, I'm really a boy. And you might think this is crazy, but this is in California law.
Yeah.
And I spoke to some parents about it, and they're really, some of the parents are really happy about it. They think, oh, it's wonderful. Why should the child be forced into a gender that he wasn't meant to be when he was born?
Exactly. Limitations of, you know, the physicality of the body, you know. Yeah, great.
And so I was thinking to myself, God, at the age of 8, what was big on my priority list at 8? Basically, it was what did mom pack in my lunchbox? Or what am I going to have for lunch? What I've smuggled into school to show my friends? Some toy or some baseball card or something, and then what we're doing at recess is who might pick a fight with who at recess at lunch. These were the priorities. These were number 1, 2, 3, and 4. The last thing that you would consider an 8-year-old to be obsessed with is what gender they are. You know, because even it's 6, 7, 8. You know. Boys and girls, there's hardly a difference. Usually the sports teams are co-mixed and everything's co-ed anyway. And unless you're raised in an all-boys or all-girls school from a young age, which not most people aren't, that's not an issue for a young kid. It's only an issue when the diversity experts introduce it into the minds. And these people who go on diversity training courses. And this is where all the money is being spent in our institutions, on those leadership training, diversity training, and they're coming back with this applied behavioral psychology, and then they're injecting it back into the student body.
Yeah.
And this is how they're indoctrinating. This is how they're collectivizing. This is the brave new world.
Yeah.
That they're changing the minds of young children. So these kids might be 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 today. But in 10 years, those are going to be 21, 22, 23,
yeah.
20, 28. And that is going to form the majority of the adult population. And they will have had very different indoctrination than you and I.
Yeah.
And even more different than our parents. And this is by design. This is an agenda. It's absolutely well-funded. It's absolutely focused. You see it manifested in various NGOs, think tanks, and especially in the charity sector. That's the silent sort of column there.
Yeah.
Is hidden in the charity sector and diversity training, racial awareness. We found that, you know, when you introduce the idea of race to people that didn't have it before, all of a sudden, surprise, surprise, they become obsessed with the differences in their race. And then they just start talking about their social economic disadvantages and who's been given a short end of the stick and who hasn't. And on these things that previously didn't exist between groups of people and individuals become more pronounced when it's introduced through by the practitioners.
Yeah.
And so this, you know, school bureaucrats, administrators, government officials, these are the decision makers that are allocating the funding for this kind of skull plugging, which is going on, and they're the ones responsible. And so the teachers who go on these courses, most of them don't even know what's been done to them, to be quite frank. And you see this with the green agenda. It was done very successfully with a lot of people just adopting that, usually through media or through other multilateral institutions and charities and Greenpeace and WWF, this idea of global warming.
Yep.
And then putting that into the school curriculum, whereby most kids are taught to basically believe that this actually exists, that the man is heating up the earth and that the sea levels will rise and the polar bears are whatever. And what that's effectively done is it's a huge own goal. We know now that a lot of the timing of the global warming phenomenon in pop culture coincided perfectly with the advent of fracking, mm-hmm. Hydraulic fracturing.
Right.
Which has been an absolute terror on the real environment. Of course, the whole environmental movement was off chasing a phantom, much like Don Quixote was attacking windmills in his novel.
Yeah.
Don Quixote is attacking the windmills because he thinks that the windmills are his enemy, his nemesis, like it's a monster. This is what global warming and climate change are, is the windmill. And the population is Don Quixote. Greenpeace is Don Quixote. WWF, Don Quixote, and all the sort of legions of green activists. who would go out and put their life on the line for a threat that is completely mythological. While all this is going on the other side, while Fukushima is happening, while the nuclear industry is posing the greatest threat to mankind's existence on this planet, where are the resources? Where is the ships? Where are all the protesters getting arrested for the nuclear industry? You know, it's not happening.
No.
And that's by design. That's not by accident.
Yeah,
you're
right.
It's by design. And the sooner people wake up to that and start focusing their energies and reprioritizing, but under this education system, it'll be harder and harder for successive generations to think independently and to act individually.
Well, let me just wing something by you here as well, while we're on the topic of education, because it was in coming out of Ohio, I think, Senate Bill 248, and was being called an offensively intrusive bill, but would basically require all homeschooling families to submit to background checks and interviews with social workers before being permitted to homeschool or enroll in an online school in the state. Parents and children would be separated for interviews, and any finding by a social worker that homeschooling was not, quote, in the best interest of the child, unquote, would be grounds for denial of the right to homeschool or enroll in an online school. Fortunately, this was put down to after what's been was called. It was just a number of people came out of the, you know, to protest this, basically, which is good, which still shows that there is some, you know, some oomph in the American population, since we in Sweden banned homeschooling in 2010. And what, you know, three families fled to the U.S., I believe, and other countries. And you didn't hear anything else, you know, about that since. But the fact is, it shows that they're trying to test those waters, kind of thing. They're like, all right, let's introduce this. Let's see where people are at. And now you're going to be seeing different things coming up about negatively putting homeschooling in a bad light. And then they're going to try it in like 2-3 years, maybe 4 or 5 from now. And they're going to slowly work at that too, right? Because that's one of the biggest problems. We have the, as they call it in Sweden, we had the prejudice of the parents being passed down onto the children if they were allowed to homeschool. So there you go.
Yeah, that is one of the front lines. I mean, we talked about this in a previous interview. We said that how academics and think tanks and so-called experts in America and also in Britain tend to point to the Nordic model as it's, yes, some sort of progressive beacon of achievement in socialization of various things, including education. So they will continually point to the Nordic model as successful, and they've achieved these results, therefore, as a test run that might be applied to a larger scale over here in Britain or bigger in America. But the issue of homeschooling is fundamental. I visited a homeschool in the west of England recently that was really started by four parents who had four kids, and they weren't happy with what was going on in their local school, and they decided to use the downstairs of their house as a homeschool. The numbers grew to 20, 24 people within 2 years, I believe. Mm-hmm. And then they had to move off site. They had to get a bigger venue because they had 40 plus.
Wow.
And, you know, some very well-intentioned parents, their only objective, absolutely their only objective, is a better education for their kids. Can you say the same about the state? Is their only objective a better education for the kids? So where would you want to put your children?
Yeah.
Would you want to put them in the smaller homeschool, or would you want to put them into the state apparatus? And where do you think the good value for the money is going to be for you?
Yeah,
and it's allowing that choice to happen, and I've seen just on a smaller kind of example of this is that, you know, there's different curriculums within schools themselves and private schools as well. See, if you eliminate homeschools, then private schools could be under attack in the future.
Next, absolutely. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So I've seen firsthand non-orthodox curriculums in private schools whereby from kindergarten to grade 9, there's no textbooks in the school. Okay. And people will say, oh my God, how can you do that? Well, the proof is in the pudding. they graduated their first class, and who took some of the class of the been with the school since its foundation 6 years ago, took the national exams, and not only did well, but passed in the higher percentiles. This is coming out of a system with no textbooks.
Wow.
So they not only competed with the other students who had been through normal education, quote unquote, they were better than them, actually. And so where does that leave them in, as far as qualifications for university? Well, it means that they are better prepared for higher education. Mm-hmm. So the proof is in the pudding.
Yeah.
It's been proven, but there's a huge effort to, discredit these sort of more sort of vanguard, maverick sort of educational movements, and write them off as not being efficient and not giving the kids what they need, when in fact it's just the opposite. The state is not giving the kids what they need, and the state is inefficient, and the state is producing generations of underqualified, undereducated people. And one has to ask the question, knowing that that is the case, knowing that performance has slipped, especially in Western countries, in comparison to, say, African countries, why isn't there an uproar, in political and social circles in our countries? Why are people not upset about this?
Right. Yeah.
That is the big million-dollar question here.
Oh boy, we're heading off a cliff, and people are just cheering, as is going down. I don't think that we really have the full see what the thing here is, that it's turned into a laboratory. I mean, okay, to a certain extent you can say that it always has been. It hasn't been under control, so to speak, before, more than the fact that what came out of the result was the combined efforts of all the individuals on the planet that did their thing, kind of, that you had parents taking the responsibility. You had a time where people are, they grew up, and they saw to it that they had the capabilities of their own survival in their own hands, kind of thing. But now it's a live, ongoing laboratory on like with psychological things and all kinds of, social engineering. And I don't think that we quite have an understanding of what, just as you pointed to, what this will produce in like 10, 20, 30, 40 years down the road, as this snowball just continues to roll and just accumulate more power and more more control, more wealth as well, ultimately. And literally, we'll be talking about a scenario where everyone will be like a brick in that wall. There will be an homogenized individual that are exactly according to the standards of what a curricula, a state has set for people. And it will take away all the ingenuity and creativity of the out of the box kind of individuals that I believe helped mankind in the past to solve situations, to get out of something, to at those incredible moments where there were we were facing tremendous obstacles. The right people have come, stepped up to the plate, and they've done some extraordinary things. If that has to do with inventions or technology or any of those things. But now I don't think we know what we're doing, really. Patrick, I think it's heading off the cliff, as I said.
It is, especially in Europe and in North America and most of the developed countries, and Japan we can include in there as well, and other, in Australia. What's happening is basically our politicians don't have the backbone, or actually don't possess the mental capability to break the news to us, in their daily speeches and through their media press releases, that we have a situation in Europe and in North America where we have 0% growth. Okay, our whole system has been based on, the debt-based fractional reserve lending system is based on economic growth.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we have to face the fact that there will be 0% economic growth, in fact, negative growth, in Europe and in North America and in many other countries. And one of the reasons this has come to be, partly is because of globalization, because this new model of 0% growth in Europe, total economic growth, is suited the top capstone of the financial pyramid.
Certainly. Oh, yeah.
So through automation and technology, it means reduced jobs, and that will only increase. That's not going to turn the other way. Technology and automation means less jobs. It means that a robot or a machine or a computer will be able to replace more and more jobs as it develops and becomes more and more automated, to the point where the robots will then be making the robots, who will then be replacing the jobs. Now, socially, it almost seems as if the social engineers are preparing a society whereby mediocrity is the new standard. So,
yeah.
So a mediocre society with 0% growth, any labor has been outsourced to poorer countries, more wealth is being transferred up to the top of the pyramid. So you have this kind of super, super hardened, super strong fascist system whereby you have a cartel, conglomerate of corporations that are completely fused with all functions of government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a certain amount of people on, social welfare, a certain amount of people doing jobs to keep busy, busy consuming other people through behavioral psychology industries, through the pharmaceutical industries, through these various other, social programs, is really consuming people. Of course, the solution to this is quite easy. If you want to reverse that, all you have to do is basically reverse the policies of globalization. And that brings us back into more nationalist thinking. In other words,
can't do that.
It's a dirty word.
Oh, yeah. Extremists.
Growing your own food, selling it locally.
Yeah. Ouch.
Making things more competitive so that supermarkets, for instance, don't dominate the whole of the food supply chain.
That's right. Yep.
And all these sort of basic things that actually existed before can easily be achieved again.
Yes.
But then you have to relook at the whole concept of the European Union. You have to relook at the concept of the all-powerful United States federal government, the World Trade Organization, and some of these other outfits. And so European common agricultural policy needs to be relooked at, is saying, is this really good for the communities? Well, clearly it's not. You're paying farmers not to sit around and not grow, and also paying for their votes and their support by giving them all that money.
Yeah.
So they'll never want to rebel against the EU, which is very cleverly what they've done over the last 40 years.
That's right.
But all these things can be reversed. But what it's going to mean is that if the government has one function at all for the interests of the people, would be to break up monopolies and to break up cartels and to break up transnational conglomerates that are owning and totally manipulating the markets. The worst example of this is the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And the Atlantic Treaty on the Atlantic side is giving all power for corporations and their lawyers and certain corporate judges to usurp and override national legislation on any given issue that might affect their potential profits, okay? And so this is the global government now coming into clear view. This is what Bilderberg has been about for the last 50 years. This is what the Trilateral Commission is about. This is what the Council on Foreign Relations has been working for. All of these think tanks and steering groups are coming now to the crescendo, and we're seeing it now, the groundwork laid for a global corporation, a global government, which sits above. It's a corporate government. It's not a government of the people by the people. It's a corporate structure which sits above all nation states. And they hope that they can absorb all nation states into these sort of unions, regional unions. And then hopefully they'll have a single currency or two or three currencies that are basically one currency because they're all pegged within 5% of each other.
Yeah.
Okay. That will basically be impossible for anybody who's not hereditarily endowed born into a corporation or born into one of the the top 300 families, for instance, or born into a political dynasty. If you don't fit any of those, then there's no way that you will actually rise up above whatever status you're at that particular time.
Yeah.
You might be able to work your way up through the bureaucracy, through the party. You know, if you're dirty enough, if you're cutthroat enough, you could be the next Karl Rove or Alistair Campbell or, you know, whatever, dirty trickster. You can win points that way. But really, the whole idea that you can save, speculate, build, grow, create, that will be taken out of people's hands, and that is the exclusive purview of the corporate community. And so, small businesses, forget about it. Grow your own food, trade your own goods, forget about that.
Yeah.
You need a license for this. You need compliance for that, and the only people who can afford all the compliance and all the licenses are people who are dealing on economies of scale, who can absorb those administrative costs.
That's right.
Or those taxes. So that's the only way you can operate.
And so again, that's ultimately what a lot of people also have demanded, right? Because, you know, we need these big corporations are earning so much, so let's tax them more. And ultimately, so what they're calling for is the very things that ultimately will shut down the small people that will be able to compete on the local levels, you know? So you attain multiple goals with those same policies that they put in place right now, because you also create that discontent between the people and the system, and then the system's going to return back and say, all right, we'll give you more of the things that you believe is going to be, working against the very system that you're complaining about, right? So it's that feedback loop of it, and no one ever looks outside of that box and questions, well, wait a minute, should we even have all these taxes? Let people roam on their own instead and let them mend for themselves and take care of it and begin to trade with people without a third party in there taking a piece of the action with tariffs and cuts and everything else, you know? But nope, that's never going to be questioned in that regard, right? It's always going to be, it's within the box of the system or it's nothing at all, you know?
And the, you know, people are probably sitting back thinking about this, saying like, well, is this the way forward? Is this the inevitable evolution of mankind and human society? And should we just relent and, you know, go with it, because it shouldn't be all that bad, you know, as long as I can buy what I need at the supermarket and as long as I can afford my rent and have my smartphone and my internet connection, I'll be able to see a few movies each month and go on holiday once, twice a year. I'll be fine. I'll be absolutely fine. But here's the problem: is this the corporate mentality, which tends to be very schizophrenic by its nature.
Yeah.
And in other words, it wants to be one thing this day, and then it has to be somebody else the next day. It's the good guy today, and it has to be the bad guy the next day.
Yeah.
And it's just schizophrenic by nature, and cannot actually make informed and logical, and cannot make decisions institutionally, is unable to make decisions that are not only for the benefit of people, but can't even make decisions for the benefit of itself. And I'll give you a perfect example of that.
Mm-hmm.
The meltdown at the Daiichi nuclear power plant in Japan, Fukushima, as it's called, potentially is the worst nuclear meltdown in the planet's history. So we're looking at this situation. We're looking at how bad it is. Well, it's difficult to know how bad it is because the media outlets and the corporations who control the politics in Japan have possibly put a lid on information. There's a lot of disinformation out there. There's a lot of hiding of facts, of people's testimonies, of scientific data. And, of course, Japan has a lot of practice with this because they had help from the Americans after the dropping of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs to end the Second World War.
Yeah.
So they have a lot of practice in this area. So here's the problem. So TEPCO and its parent companies and its international partners have quite a lot of financial resources, but because of the bottom line of their balance sheet and because of their shareholders, they could not act with absolute certainty to confront the problem as it happened back in 2011, or when it happened is, or 2010, I can't remember when Fukushima actually happened, but it's been a few years now, and the radiation, it potentially has gone China syndrome, where it's gone down into the water table, it's burned right down through the floor, and it's also escaped into the sea. It's affecting the biosphere. So we have a major, major situation here.
Yeah. It was 11, by the way, March 11th, 2011. So almost we're coming up on a third year here, you know?
So you're looking at the main reason why they didn't attack this was financial, okay? And it's still the same reason today. Mm. And you have to look at this and think that so if humanity itself is in danger, the human species, as a result of this particular accident in Japan, and they cannot mobilize together to see that this is a priority, that their operations will come to an end anyway. If the Japanese economy collapses because of this eventually, that's going to cause a ripple effect worldwide. Everyone's going to lose. Currencies will collapse. Whole regions of trade will be destroyed. There'll be mass immigration. There'll be costs to be borne that we can't even calculate, right?
Yeah.
So, and it's all because they say they can't afford it. It's too expensive. Mm-hmm. But if the Saudis and the Israelis and the Americans and the British and the Germans and the Swedes and the Italians, if let's say tomorrow, if David Cameron and all the sort of high-ranking British people just said, right, we're making an emergency speech. We've realized that the situation in Japan is gone critical, and we are all going to be facing down the barrel of a gun right now.
Yeah.
We are going to basically, all of our political activity, all of our resources are going to be focused on this problem from here, from today until it's solved. What would happen if that such an announcement was made? What would happen the next day? It would be in the media. It would cascade around the planet like basically a wildfire.
Mm-hmm.
Within weeks, everybody is going to just be looking at this as something that's a major problem. And there's plenty of money out there to solve this problem.
Sure is.
Me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So why hasn't it been done to this point? Because this corporate intelligence by its nature has a lack of intelligence. It doesn't know what it is. It doesn't know why it exists. It just is, and it just exists. And so you wouldn't need any money to solve the Fukushima problem. Everyone would just donate.
Exactly. I mean,
right down the supply chain. Yeah. Donate labor, donate and everything to backstop what's behind that. In the end, maybe it's some Saudi Arabian sheikh saying, here's 4 billion barrels of oil. That's for you guys to sort out that problem.
Yeah.
You know, so everyone would, money wouldn't even technically need to change hands. It's not a question of money. It is a question of will.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's a question of will, political will, corporate will, individual will. It's just purely a question of will. And the fact that humanity lacks the will to deal with and prioritize these types of problems says a lot about the quality of this corporate world order, that it really is lacking in quality, in intelligence. It's lacking all the fundamental things that's required to lead.
Well, it just the will thing alone, I mean, that you mentioned before, and that's what we talked about here, really, it's that when you have this mechanized system of the machine culture taking over the most fundamental aspects of human drives, even the will to exist and just sustain itself, to be ordered to live, which is a prerequisite situation when you arrive to this planet. There's no animal out there anywhere on this planet that just, you know, sits around and says, you know, whatever, and it will be taken care of and everything will be good. It has to have a basic capability and an intention and a will to survive and take care of itself first, you know, and then everything else kind of falls from that. But to me, it seems like that is what's been bred out of people at this stage. They have a very basic realization. And I think that a reflection of that as well, why the system, as you say, is so stupid, why it's schizophrenic ultimately, is because it's trying to also at the same time cater to all these different needs, which are going to be contradictory. That's why you don't get a coherent direction where it flows in. All it does is grows bigger and larger, like a cancer, really. But it doesn't really know what to do about anything. It's the greatest disservice in the history of mankind, what we're doing right now.
Yeah, and you know what is it? You actually touched on a really important point, and you're sort of getting at there. What you just said is really embodying what it means to be human. And what does it mean to be human? I had a conversation with somebody recently who's more of the kind of holistic new age kind of bent, and fantastic person who's a practitioner and alternative healing and stuff. And we were talking about this same issue. And I said, look, you know, what is it? You know, we're humans. What is the difference between a human? And I pointed over on the table. There was a beautiful orchid, a plant. Or a lily, and I said, and the plant, and she's, well, and this person said to me, we need to learn to be more like this plant. And I said, I understand where you're coming from there. I said, but actually, what the difference between that plant and us as a human is, if there's a problem over there, we can go and sort it out. Mm-hmm. The plant just is. It's just there, and it does its thing, and it's great, and we benefit from that plant being there. However, as humans, human nature is taking action. You can talk and you can be like a tree in the forest, and you can think about things, you can observe stuff for a certain period of time. At some point, you will have to actually step forward and take action. And that's what defines a human being. And we are raising generations of people that are like trees in the forest that will not step forward, will not reach out, will not even reach out to help their fellow man, let alone reach out to put out a fire. You know, or to stop something that could be potentially horrific. So that is essential to human nature throughout human history, is humans' ability to act, to take action for good and for bad.
Yeah.
But that ultimately defines the human, is what they've done, not what they've said, not what they've thought about, but what they actually did.
That's right. Yeah.
And that's one of the original tenets of it. I looked in, you know, discussed this issue with a lot of people who are in the Buddhist religion in the West. There's a huge amount of people, millions of people, in fact, that belong to kind of an organized international Buddhist organization, okay? Mm. And one of their people had been in there for years, since his teenage years, and he's well into his, I guess, his 50 now. And he is one of the great proponents of Buddhism, but he came to me very frustrated a couple of years ago. He said, you know, it's frustrating that most of these people that I'm with, they just want to chant all day for things that they want, or like praying, and which is good, which is a positive thing. However, he said, the original Buddhists in the early days were like activists. They were like revolutionaries. They were challenging, confrontational even, and they did things, you know. They went out and put themselves out to do things and make things happen.
Yeah.
And he said that he's sad that he thinks that we've completely lost that original spirit from that particular religion, has been replaced with kind of this more of a passive ideology, whereby it's better just not to get involved, not to step out, not to put yourself on the line, but to hold back and then just think about it and hope that things get better. You know, well, if a train is coming and your whole family is tied down to the tracks, you know, you can chant all you want, but that train's going to keep coming, and it's going to end up running over everybody.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of like where I think we're at. And a lot of the very intelligent people, you know, middle class, well educated, intelligent, superbly talented in a creative way, and a lot of these people have been ring fenced into some of these movements. Okay.
Yeah.
And some of them are good movements that have become cults, and there's many different versions of this. The ecstasy culture is probably the biggest sort of catch net for the last 20 years for young people in Europe, that has basically gone and snared most of the young great minds and basically snared them into the music and drugs culture. And within those groups, within those communities, potentially are the real movers and shakers, actually, in terms of, you know, revolutionary type thinkers. And I think that is also by social engineering design that happened and was introduced to that particular strata of society. Just as crack was introduced to poor blacks in Los Angeles in the early 80s for a specific purpose, for a specific reason, a designer drug for that time in that place with that group of people, the same thing they did with ecstasy culture and recreational drugs throughout history have been introduced to certain people at certain times for certain purposes. And for the most part, what was achieved is a kind of, it's muted awakenings. It gives you kind of a temporary awakening thing. It's great, you know, it's fantastic. I can see multi-dimensions and all this stuff, and it's great for my art and my music and everything. But in the long run, it's kept you within that little playground.
And
I think this is why the corporate, the insidious corporate agenda, the pernicious corporate agenda has been able to basically move at such a pace at a time when you'd think that there would be the most resistance. In other words, information has never been more available. People have never been more informed. And the awakening is definitely happening in many places. But the mass of the awakening has been handicapped a bit by a lot of these different things that have been introduced and absolutely controlled and, almost managed, I would say. You know, the counterculture drugs has been managed.
Oh, yeah.
Very, very efficiently, yep. Almost scientifically. So this is social engineering, and it's in places that you might not think it exists. You might think that's the counterculture over there, when in fact that's kind of a nice little trap that's been, you know, a nice little theme park that's been designed for certain people of a certain age, of a certain educational background, of a certain racial makeup or whatever, to go in that one, you know, and stay there for 10 years. 15 years.
I know. Well, even the marketeers, the market industry has learned to harness the power of the counterculture. In fact, that's been the driving, force of where it's tried to push its fashion, etc., to try to basically decode the counterculture in order to cater to those people who think that they go against the grind kind of thing, because it's a very, popular thing to do. But ironically, of course, in that process, you end up being part of the mainstream, as you think you're counterculture. So it's absolutely, I couldn't agree more, Patrick. Now, let me ask you this before we, because we could just go talking about those things alone for several more hours. But I wanted to ask you a little bit more while we have some time left here. There are a couple of things on the agenda. I wanted to see what you think is the most important, and we'll see how many of these we can get to. But we have the story of Loretta Fuddy. We have the Mandela issue. There's also the Sandy Hook and the Boston bomber thing that's kind of re-echoed back into the media again. And then we have the Sudan thing. Which of these things are most important? What would you like to talk about?
I think the anniversary of Sandy Hook and also the trial of the Johar, the surviving alleged Boston bomber, I think these are really definitely something important because the two are intricately related. And recently, the Boston bombing story has reemerged in the media, even briefly, because of this trial. The Boston Globe wrote an extensive piece, basically, which seemed to be conciliatory towards Tamerlan Tsarnaev and also the brother. The older brother obviously died, we're told, in custody, was run over, and had some wounds on him that we couldn't quite explain. But so the Globe's done this. Okay, this is a very interesting psyop. And he's heard voices in his head. So then the alternative media is calling MK Ultra. Is he a mind control victim? And, and then the mainstream media is translating this as, oh, he's just completely nuts. He's a nutty fanatic who's hearing voices. What we're saying is that this extensive piece by the Boston Globe is also part of a larger kind of Operation Mockingbird type psyop. It's causing the public to focus on the mental state of these two brothers because the younger brother is currently going on trial, while ignoring the complete long list of obvious anomalies which were visible during and after the Boston bombings themselves. That's so basically, this is an attempt to create a layer of topsoil over what was clearly visible with regards to Boston, which we talked about on your show six, seven months ago. And that's really important because it's about re-spinning the narrative. And Sandy Hook is also very interesting because that one has been challenged by a number of people. And we're gonna show a presentation on our by Sophia Smallstorm on our website on Christmas Day, which we'll release on Christmas Day, which some people have already seen, but we just wanted to represent it. Basically, talking about the five dimensions of Sandy Hook, and this is a fantastic presentation. If you really want to get deep into how reality is warped, we're talking about the three dimensions of what happened. What you can see on the television screen, and then there's the fourth dimension, which is how we react to it as a population. If you look at this as one giant test tube that we're in a Sandy Hook test tube, we're part of the experiment. And how, in other words, what we observe, how we react to it. And then there's a fifth dimension, and the fifth dimension is what we are going to do about what we've discovered. Okay,
yep.
That is also part of the experiment, and everything. These events are bigger than the event themselves. These events stretch way past the events themselves. They include us, how we observe it, how we react to it, and what actions we might take as a result of what we've discovered. That's all part of the experiment, and I believe Boston is the same thing. You just look. I mean, the anomalies are obvious and well cataloged by hundreds and hundreds of people, including this presentation by Sophia Smallstorm, but and Boston the same, and it's so we're paying attention to the fourth and fifth dimensional aspects of these events because I think they're really important. It's how this will determine ultimately how they're written in history, and on the Hegelian dialectic side, what's going to be the imposed solutions to the outrage of the events themselves. And so, yes, another layer of psychological flipping that which is going on at the moment.
Interesting. Well, we actually had Sophia Smallstorm with us also many years ago now. We talked about doing some interesting work on the nano aspect to chemtrails, basically. But I haven't seen this presentation before. I need to take a look at that once it's up there because it does sound interesting. Now, is there a little bit more of that you would want to just, you know, talk about where you see that thing is going of how that situation has been used? I mean, I've said that for years as well, that it's every event in itself, no matter how much it's planned to be that way, it always has a multifaceted aspect to it, and it can be used in so many different ways. And again, it doesn't mean that, you know, every component of that is an active, you know, conspiracy and all that. There are things that happens in the both in the mental realm of people when they focus on this, but again, you have large groups of people that, you know, you concentrate on these kinds of events. But the fact is, you get an extraordinary amount of, you know, like residual, you know, changes that occur throughout the entire society when these things happen. Is that kind of a little bit where she goes with this, or is it more that, you know, there's the event themselves have produced something different that we didn't think about, basically?
Yeah, I think the obvious one is gun control in America.
Certainly, yeah.
It's gun control, and with regards to Boston, it's keeping the war on terror going strong on a domestic front, not just a Middle Eastern front or a global front, but domestic front, and resources and money, people not being upset about money and resources being allocated to, say, the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, rather than being allocated to things that people actually need. And that's one of the things that Boston achieved. And also a test run to see if people would be upset or, you know, hit back against a martial law situation, which happened in Boston, which there was no blowback from. So these are also things to be perfected. So in other words, if you put out fake pictures of someone's fake family albums and people find the anomalies, the photoshopping or whatever, you can even put stuff out intentionally that looks very dodgy and see if people actually blow back against it. Because then, you know, the next time when the next one comes, the next mass shooting or the next unexplainable bombing, it's going to be, the backstories will be that much more detailed and that much more professional and harder to pick out the anomalies. We're living in a world of digital illusion. You know, the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, one of the caveats in that bill was the repealing of the Smith-Munt Act. And the Smith-Munt Act made it illegal for the government to engage in propaganda on domestic shores within the United States. And that was taken out as part of the NDAA. So that could have opened the floodgates of, you know, the gates of hell, in my opinion, whereby a situation like Boston is legal. If the government decides to do it, it's not illegal. There's no one saying it's right, but you're saying that it's not illegal. So you could stage a Boston bombing. You can bring in actors. You can have fake blood. You can have people pretending to be victims. You can use, you know, flash bombs and Hollywood pyrotechnics. But it's not illegal because the government deems this as to be an absolutely needed security exercise for the greater good. Okay. So we're in the point now of taking away actual legislation that forbids government from engaging in domestic propaganda. And that's the situation that America is in right now. And it's, you know, those laws weren't even on the books in most European countries. So it's like,
well, exactly. Yeah.
You know, so but America is the battleground as far as that piece of, you know, founding father document, to have a written bill of rights, to have a living, breathing constitution, to have separation of powers that America had as a structure, that is the battleground. You have to smash that. You have to defeat that. You have to take away all the things that were God-given rights imbued upon every man. You have to smash that in order to achieve real domination. That is a huge domino that needs to fall.
Well, exactly. And I mean, it's not that they follow the laws, that are set for everyone else anyway, but they do run the risk of getting caught or one piece in the wrong place being released in a paper and then it's off. You know, they do run the risk of being both sued and basically people go after them. But the fact is that if they didn't even have that legal framework there, it would just be so much more easier for them to do the kind of stuff that they wanted to do with all their sting operations and theatrics and everything else. So yeah, I believe you're right. I need to take a look at that. Sounds interesting.
Yeah, the other thing that was really fascinating was Luke Radowski from We Are Change put out a video a couple of weeks ago, which we reposted on 21st Century Wire, whereby they took a Galaxy Samsung or an Android phone. I can't remember which phone it was. They took the phone and found the IP address of where the data from this phone is talking to, what data center, and it was the British Ministry of Defense. And this is a mobile carrier in New York. And in the UK, someone did the same thing and found that their data was being routed through the Department of Defense in America. So in order to have their legal hands clean, people need to understand that what the governments of the United States, Britain, and Australia, and others, Germany, France, are doing is they outsource all their illegal activity to their partners overseas. Mm. And that's why the U.S. listing base and data collection centers, the big ones, are in Australia and in Great Britain and not on U.S. soil. It's to provide the criminal element with a legal out. And so there's no subpoena powers or anything like this. As long as each government is in kind of agreement and maybe money changes hands and corporations are allowed to feed into the data trough and some money's being made there, everybody's happy and no one's going to really know what's going on. They do the same thing with their assassination squads. If someone wants to kill someone in France, they'll hire, it'll be a hit squad from another country and vice versa.
Mossad or something, you know, they're bringing a different force. Yeah, exactly.
Sure. It's same way the mafia does it, you know.
Yeah.
When there's mafia turf wars, they're bringing an outside party to do the dirty job so it doesn't come back to any of this family over here, so it doesn't cause a family war. And they do the same thing with their spying operations, with their data gathering, tracking, all the things that are illegal, all the things that are actually against your rights as a free citizen are all done and outsourced offshore. And just the cynical design of this should be enough for people to say that, you know, this is completely unacceptable on so many levels. But it's the fact that most people haven't actually copped on to the gravity of what is actually being done here. And making it, a lot of it comes back to, we still live in a nation of laws. We still live in a nation where laws are on the books. Laws must be respected. So how do you circumvent laws? Well, one way is to repeal them. One way is to offshore the crime so that no one's fingerprints is actually on it in the country where the law is on the books against it. So this is how they're operating.
Yeah.
And they're doing it almost out in the open now. And, you know, it really is incredible. And I don't know how long it's going to take for the penny to actually drop, whereby people are going to realize that, you know, the DDR isn't ancient history. You know, it's very real indeed.
The Stasi is well and alive and kicking, as it were. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Incredible.
Well, oh my, I mean, this is indeed, it's all true. It's all very sad, but you know, the fight continues. That's the only way about this, and keep spreading the word, Patrick, keep informing people, because it's good stuff, and no matter how uncomfortable it is, people need to hear it. If they do indeed have that drive anymore of sustaining their own their own lives, basically, and being in control of their own destiny. Otherwise, it will fall into the hands of others. But thanks again, Patrick, for coming on. We always appreciate it. It's always good stuff. Remind us again, by the way, before you leave us with whatever else you want to say here. But remind us when you expect your film to be out due, Patrick.
I think we're gonna probably have it finished in February, and we're hoping to get it in some film festivals that are not exclusive premieres, because we obviously want to get it, as soon as it's done, we want to get it out. We don't want to wait for the film festival, you know,
sure, yeah,
that whole thing where you sit on it for a year before anybody actually sees it. We want to get it out as soon as possible. So it will probably be in February. And I worked with a very, very good investigator who really is who came, this is his project, really, and I was just kind of a partner on it. But his name's Malcolm, and he works for the UK column. Supremely good job, which he's done. And it's on the foot-in-mouth crisis in Britain. And a lot of countries and people who are in touch with rural lifestyle and rural issues will really resonate with this documentary film. It will be visible when we have it out. We'll have it out as many places as we can, and people will be able to see it. It's very powerful stuff. It's probably the most hard-hitting thing I've ever done in terms of real where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. It's pretty heavy. It's pretty heavy stuff, but absolutely well-researched and well-investigated.
Well, that's excellent. Looking forward to it. It's going to be very exciting. And indeed, I remember when that whole story went down, it was a couple of waves of it. It was just very, very interesting and suspicious activities that went on around that time. So I definitely think you guys are going to be able to dig out some good stuff on that. But in the meantime, then, Patrick, we'll relay people further to 21stcenturywire.com, the website. You know, keep up with the news. Good stories coming through there all the time. So thanks again, Patrick. Really appreciate it. Have a good one. Have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, by the way. And then we'll talk more in the next one, okay?
You too, Henrik.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us in the member section. And thank you for your membership as well. We couldn't do this without you guys. I hope you have a nice Christmas. Enjoy your time with your friends and or family. And we'll speak to you again in just a few days. Amy Vickers is up next. Then we have Terry Melanson, Randall Carlson, James Hall, Robert Bouval, David Talbot, and Robert Dewhurst as well. All right, we'll talk to you in just a few days. Take it easy. See you later.